Okay, we're beginning here three lines down on the top of Nun Amud Aleph. The Gemara is continuing to bring takanot that were established in Usha and to discuss those takanot. So now we have over here, Amar Rabbi Yiloh, Be'usha Hitkinu. In Usha they establish, HaMevazvez, Ayevazvez Yoter Michomesh. The person who is going to give of his monies should not give more than a fifth, should not give more than 20%. Tanya Nami Hochi, we have a brayta that supports that. HaMevazvez, Ayevazvez Yoter Michomesh. Person's going to make expenditures, give to, Rashi says over here, the aniyim, to the poor, give tzedakah. He should not exceed 20%. Shema yitzarech debriyot. Because then he may then fall himself into the need for tzedakah. Maseh be'achad, shebikesh levezvez yoter michomesh. There was an incident where an individual had wanted to expend more than 20%. Ve'oniach lo chaveiro. And his friend did not allow him to do it. Umanu. And who is that? It's Rabbi Yeshvav. Ve'amri lo Rabbi Yeshvav. Ve'lo nichu chaveiro. Umanu is Rabbi Kiva. So in the first instance, it's Rabbi Yeshvav that stopped the other party. In the second version, it was Rabbi Yeshvav who wanted to expend the money. And Rabbi Akiva was the one who stopped him. Amar Rav Nachman, V'itemar Rav Acha bar Yaakov, Mikra. What is the source for this? Where do we find this in the Psukim? So they quote from Yaakov Avinu, V'chol asher titen li, aser asrenu lach. That everything you give to me, the Pashtura Pasuk is that I will take off 10%, that I will take off maaser. But the Gemara is reading it is aser asrenu, is 2 of the 10th. But the Gemara asks the obvious question, which is, Valo dami yisura batro li yisura kama. The first 10% is different than the second 10%. If one is to remove 20%, for instance, from 100, then that would be 20. On the other hand, if one removes 10% from 100, that's 10. And then if you remove a second 10% from the residual, which is 90, then it's only 9. It's 19 in total. So that's not 20%. Amar Rav Ashi, Asrenu ba'atra kikama. The way that the pasuk is written, and Rashi says this, the fact that it says Asrenu, instead of saying Aser, Aser, that teaches us that the second Isur is equal to the first Isur. The second tenth is equal to the first tenth, and therefore just like the first tenth is 10, the second tenth will also be 10, and that equivalent to 20%. Then Amar Rav Shimi Barashi, Shmuot olalu mitma'atot vehochot. These shmuot go and diminish. V'simanech. And the way to remember it is kitanim, kitvu, ubezbuzu. Which is the three memorot that we had with regards to Usha. In the first instance, back in yesterday's daf, we had Amar Rabbi Yiloh, Amar Reish Lakish, Mishum Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, Be'usha itkinu she'adam zanet banav v'et benotav she'en ketanim. So that's the word ketanim. And over there, the attribution is to Rabbi Yiloh in the name of Reish Lakish, in the name of Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, or Rabbi Yehuda Bar Chanina. The second thing that we said from Usha was, Amar Rabbi Yiloh, Amar Reish Lakish. So over there, instead of having three parties that have the Mesorah and the attribution, over there, we only have two parties, which is Amar Rabbi Yiloh, Amar Reish Lakish. And over there was Be'usha Itkinu, Hakutev, Kol Nechasa Levanav, Huvishto, Nizanimehem. So that's the Kitvo part of it. Then the third memra, which is the one we brought today, was just Amar Rabbi Yiloh alone. So in the first case, you have three people in the Mesorah. The second case, two people in the Mesorah. And the last case, you have one person in Mesorah. And that's the order of Ketanim, Kitvo, Ubezbezu, of the memra to deal with Usha from Rabbi Yiloh. Now, as far as this statement of Rabbi Yiloh, Usha itkinu mevazvez, ayevazvez yoter michomesh, the way to understand it is, of course, a machloket rishonim, as to how or what the expenditures can be made. So Tosafot already introduces the idea that, shepam rishona, the first time, yechol levazvez chomesh, a person can give 20% of their underlying wealth, of their savings, in the first shot. But then after that, mikan ve'elech, b'chol shana v'shana, yiten chomesh ha'revach. From that day forward, he should only give 20% of his profits and not of his underlying principal. So the first time you can give 20% of the principal, from that point forward, you can give 20% of whatever's earned, whatever profits that the individual has. What we're speaking about here, for instance, the Rambam indicates that this statement is only made with regards to Kodesh or Hekdesh. It's not made with regards to Tzedakah. On the other hand, you can see Rashi here says, "Mevazvez le'aniyim," to the poor, which would indicate that it's referencing Tzedakah and not just Hekdesh or Kodesh. Rashi in other places seems to align more closely with the Rambam, that it's talking about Hekdesh or Kodesh, that a person shouldn't give more than a Chomesh. Now, in terms of giving a Chomesh in general, how do we view the Chomesh itself? Do we look at that as simply an upper limit? Or would you look at that as the L'chatchila amount to give? So, first of all, because of the nature of the way that it's expressed, which is Shemi Itzterech Lebriot, because then he may fall to the coffers of Tzedakah, then this, in some ways, will be very subjective. So, for instance, a person who on their deathbed is distributing money, he can give Yoter Michomesh, because he's going to pass away. When he passes away, then there's no issue of Shemi Itzterech Lebriot, and therefore a person could give away Yoter Michomesh at that point in time. In addition, if a person is extremely wealthy, by which even after they give away a Chomesh, there'll be plenty of residual afterwards, it would seem that they're not bound by this limit of 20%, because the whole problem is Shem Yitzterech Lebriot, and this individual clearly will not get to this point. In addition, many believe that the proper way to give tzedakah, it may not be the minimum, but the proper way to give tzedakah is a chomesh. That 20% is the generous level to give tzedakah. That people want to give the minimum amount, they talk about somewhere between, some say 2%, some say 10% that should be given, but 20% is a normal and generous way to give. It might be even the proper way to give. Even though a person may not be obligated to give that amount, it still is a nice amount to give and something that people should aspire to in giving 20%. Whereas in excess of that starts to become a burden for the individual. And then we say even if they voluntarily want to give it, we stop them at that point because we don't want them to tzerech lebriot. So as opposed to viewing it here, as it seems in the Gemara, as being a ceiling and being an extreme form of giving tzedakah, many of the poskim quote it as being the proper amount to give or the generous way to give, and that it's okay to give 20%. It's actually very commendable to give 20%. Again, that whether there's a minimums or what the minhagim are with regards to giving, whether it's smaller amounts like 2%, or the Gemara in the Bavli gives other minimums for tzedakah or to be yotze in the midst of tzedakah, but the standard practice by many people is 10%, but it seems that, according to many of the Rishonim and the Poskim, that 20% is a goal to aspire to. What you're asking about, why is there a difference between Hekdesh and Aniyim, might be that this limit is only set because Shem Yitzterech Lebriot, when the only consideration is your standing. But if there are people in need, and serious need, then maybe we would waive this problem because we're balancing here of a question of Shem Yitzterech Lebriot versus Aniyim or people who really have needs now that we need to satisfy, and they'll definitely be in problem situation if we don't give them now. So in that case, we might be able to waive the Shema Yitzterech Lebriot in cases if you believe this is really only about Hekdesh and not about Tzedakah, or even if you believe it is about Tzedakah, that might not be governed by the same rules when there's an immediate need versus when we're just talking about the plausibility that someone might fall into needing tzedakah because they gave too much. All right, now we move on with a new round of takanot from Usha, but obviously the attribution are quoted from others, which is Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. B'ushit kinu she'adam mitgalgelim b'no ad 12 shana. That a person can roll around, we'll call it, with his son until 12. Mikan ve'elech yoroi dimolu chayav. From that point forward, he goes to for the jugular. The way Rashi explains it is, up to 12 years old, the person can speak nicely, encouraging, use verbal coercion in order to have their child learn and go on the Derech HaYashar. Once they reach the age of 12 and it's not working so well, then you start using more force or you use more strong arm tactics with the child. And that's the way that Rashi says, "Lirdoto biritzua ubechoser lechem," to use the whip and withholding of food in order to engender the outcome or behavior that the person wants. So that's the way Rashi explains it. They continue to explain the Gemara in this way, but You should just know that the Aruch has a very interesting interpretation here, where he says that Adam mitgagel im bino, ad 12 shana, is that a person should let a child learn Torah until the age of 12 without burdening them with anything else. From that point forward, Yoredi Melech Hayav, he's got to teach him a new manut. He's got to teach him a profession. He's got to teach him a way to make a living. It's interesting. It's a very, very different view than what Rashi says over here, but just to know that the Aruch says that. The Gemara says, Zini, is that really true? Amar Lei Rav, the Rav Shmuel Bar Shilat. Didn't Rav tell Rav Shmuel Bar Shilat, who was a Malamed Tino cult, Botzer mi Bar Shit, lo takbil. Below the age of 6, do not accept anybody into your classes. Bar Shit, kabel, from the age of 6, you can accept him. Vesafi Lei Ketorah, and stuff him like a shore. Feed him and keep feeding him and stuff the Torah into him. The Gemara says, in. Safi Lei Ketorah. Mihu, in your reading, Mother Chayav. There's a difference. Safi Lei Ketorah means that you stuff him, you feed him, you give him tons to learn, and you push him hard to learn and acquire knowledge at that point in time. But you still don't use the strong arm tactics that we would expect at 12. So these are different stages along the way. Now, in terms of how this reconciles with what we have in the Mishnah Navot, Tosfot already takes that up and says, V'ha'atznan b'mesechet Avot ben chamesh shanim le'mikra. Doesn't it say in Avot that it's 5 years old you start learning Mikra? And over here it seems to be that the threshold is 6. So he says, no, that's hanu legalgel, velo lemisfile. That's just to let him play around to get used to learning. So he starts out, it's like kindergarten or before the real thing. Then he goes into learn Mikra at the age of 5. By the time he gets to age of 6, then you start pressing much harder on him. You put pressure on him to learn a tremendous amount, to take down a tremendous amount. So that's how Tosfot learns it. There are others that reconcile by saying that 6 doesn't mean the end of his 6th year, but rather the beginning of his 6th year. And the beginning of his 6th year then would equate to the 5 years old, and then it would be equivalent to the Mishnah in Avot. So also this idea of stuffing him like a shore is something that has been proven over time, that children at a young age have the capacity to take in a tremendous amount of information and remember that information, and it stays with them for the rest of their lives. So the idea is here to press hard on them to get the basics, to get the fundamentals down, because then they can spend the rest of their life, they can spend thinking about it, svara, all the other things that they want to do. Once they have this basis will be with them forever. Their mikra, that will stay with them. And that's why we want to push hard on the children, to acquire that knowledge at the younger age. So, ad la'achar 12 shana. You're reading mochayav, that's when he's 12. V'ibayitema lokasho. The difference, halamikra, halamishnah. Depends what we're talking about here. We're talking about Torah, talking about Tanakh. That's at the lower threshold, which is 6 years old. And then the Mishnah is the upper threshold, which is 12 years old. So now, damar Abayi, amar liyem. So Abayi says, my mother said, and we know that Abayi did not have a mother, his mother passed away, so it was the woman who brought him up, whether it was his nurse, it was his stepmother, Barshit the Mikra, 6 years old for learning Tanakh, Bareser the Mishnah, 10 years old for Mishnah, Bartzleisar le Tanito mi 8 to 8. From 13 years old, then mi 8 to 8, you fast 24-hour periods, Ubertinoket, and when we're dealing with a young girl, Bartresar, 12 years old is the threshold. Now Rashi claims over here that the age of 12 and the age of 13 we're talking about here is not 12 years and one day, and is not 13 years and one day. Rather, it is the year before. It's the beginning of their 12th year, the beginning of their 13th year. Because Rashi says, look, if they're 12 years and one day, then they're chayavin mi d'oraita. And if they are 13 years and one day, chayav d'oraita. So then what do you need by his mother or stepmother to tell you that? Of course, they're chayavim in the fast for 24 hours. So Rashi says this is chinuch. In the year before, that the year prior, that there's a chinuch of a 24-hour fast, that one fast in the year prior to their bar mitzvah, or year prior to their bat mitzvah, then they do the full fast. Before then, that time, they only do taniyot l'sha'ot. They only do partial fasts. In the year before, they do the 24 hours, the full fasting during that period of time. That's the way Rashi explains this statement of Abaye's mother. On the other hand, Tosafot says, Ulari nira, the bat yud bet shana biyom echad. that we're literally talking about 12 years in one day and 13 years in one day. So then what about the obvious question that Rashi asks, which is then your chayavim midoraita? Why do you need Abaye's mother to tell you that? So he says, Mashmina and delayed lehashlama derabanan, that this is telling us that the halacha is that you never are mashlim before bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah. There's only chinuch l'sha'ot prior to your bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah. And therefore what they're saying is we subscribe to that opinion, that practicing for taniyot only manifests itself in partial fast, never in a complete fast. The only time you completely fast is once you hit the age of bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah. And that's the way Tosafot learns it. Number two is, Rashi says something interesting here. She says that the reason that tinoket is at 12 and a tinok is at 13 is shehima meheret lavi koach, because she, we'll call it, matures faster, has more strength. She'ena mateshet koach b'limud haTorah, because she's not weakened by limud haTorah. So Rashi claims that this practice of doing it at 12 and 13, which Rashi claims is a year before, is chinuch. The reason the girls start with chinuch a year earlier is because they're not weakened by limud haTorah. Therefore, they have the capacity to deal with fasting. Tosafot says, I don't understand. Why does Rashi have to even go down that path? We know that bar and bat mitzvah are 13 in one day and 12 in one day. So if you're going to do it a year before, that just makes it from the time 11 year in one day and 12 year in one day. Why do you have to give this explanation about meteshet koach from the Torah? It just simply says it's a year before they reach the point of being a gadol. So you could argue that Rashi is explaining why girls reach the age of maturity earlier because they're not weakened by Torah, although Tosafot seems to think that that's not the reason. It's a biological phenomenon that the girls reach maturity earlier, and therefore their period of chinuch will also start earlier than the boys, and therefore he rejects Rashi's explanation seemingly over here that says it has to do with limud haTorah. Right, so then, as Tosafot explains now, according to Abaye's mother, what you'll have is, at the age of 6, you'll start learning mikra, and at that point, safi leke Torah, you'll stuff them like a shur. Then when you reach the age of 10 for Mishnah, then you milgalgeling to. You let him fall, you let him get used to it at the Mishnah. And then the age of 12, then you take him to task if he isn't shaping up, if he isn't dealing with learning the Mishnah properly from the age of 10. So what Tosafot says is there's not a consistency here that the age of 6 and 10 are actually different. The threshold of 6 is a time when you get serious about learning. And the age of 10 is when you give him a chance to acquaint himself with the Mishnah and to get used to it and stay with the program. If he doesn't do that, then at 12, you start pressing on him much harder. So that means that the 6 and 10 will look a little differently in terms of the way that we deal with them vis-a-vis Mikra versus vis-a-vis Mishnah. So then, in addition to that, we have Amar Abaye, Amar Liaim. We have another Abaye while we're bringing down things that his nurse or his stepmother said. We have another thing, which is Habar Shit, this 6-year-old child, the Tarkele Akraba Biyoma de Mishlam Shit, that is stung by a scorpion on the last day of his 6th year, Lo Chaye, he will not live. Maya Sute, what is the cure, the medicinal cure that we can bring to him? Mirirta Didayo Chivarto, the gall of a white stork, Bishichra in beer, Neshafye, you rub it on him, Venashkiye, and you give him to drink it. Hai Barshata, the Tariq Le Zibora, a child who is 1 year old, who is stung by a bee or a wasp, Biyoma de Mishlam Shata, on the day that he's completing his 1st year, Lo Chaye, will not survive. Again, Maya Sute, what is the cure for that? Atzvato de Dikla, it is the creepers of the bark of the palm tree, the Maya, in water. Neshafya, again, you put it, wipe it on him, Nashkiye, and then you give him to drink. David asked the question, well, it says Lo Chaye is not going to live, then why are you giving me a cure after it says you're not going to live? So Rashi says, Lo Chaye im lo berefua beduka. He won't survive unless you use something that is a well-known medicinal cure for this. You got to go right to the solution, otherwise the person won't survive. Tosafot, for that reason, brings for the Beinu Tam and says, Lo Chaye means he's not going to live. Therefore, this is a preventative medicine, not a cure after the fact. And he says that the suggestion here is you do this in order to prevent the possibility of him getting stung, because if he gets stung, he won't survive. And he reads Lo Chaye literally, that you can't live. If you can't live, then there's no use in talking about a cure. The cure would only be if it was preventative medicine. The reason not to say it like that is that mirta d'dayo chivarta, the gall of a white stork, is not kosher. And therefore, only if a person was a subject to sakana, would we allow them to ingest something that is not kosher. We wouldn't, as a preventative medicine, let them do that. If there wasn't ready and apparent danger to the child, we wouldn't let them just drink this as a preventative medicine. So for that reason, many favor Rashi's interpretation of it being a cure rather than a preventative medicine. Amar Rav Katina, Kol HaMachni said, Bino Pachot B'Ben Sheish, Ratzach HaRav Ve'enu Megiyo. Anybody who starts his child learning Torah under the age of 6 will chase after him for the rest of his life, Ve'enu Megiyo, and will not catch up to them, as Rashi explains here, from a health perspective. He will always be weak because he started learning early and Torah is Mateshet Korach of the person. And because of that, he will remain weak and you'll never be able to get him to be fully healthy because he started learning Torah so early. Ikadamre, Chavirim Ratzim Acharav, Vein Meginoto. Others say that from the positive perspective, which is his friends will always chase him and they will never catch him because he got a head start. And his head start put him ahead for the rest of his life and nobody will ever catch up with him. V'tarvayu itnehu. And the truth is, both of them are true. Chalish v'gamir. He'll be weak, but he'll be very erudite. So it will help him in the success of learning Torah and being ahead of his peers, but on the other side, from a health perspective, he will always be weak. Ibai zema, some say, ha'dekochish ha'debaryo. Depends on the nature of the child. The weaker child then will be problematic. If he starts early, then that will maintain that weakness and he will never gain his full strength. On the other hand, if the child is very healthy, then starting at the age of 6 will only be to his benefit in the fact that he'll get ahead of his peers because he is healthy. And we see this in other areas of chinuch as well, that many times the Gemara will give bar chamish bar shit, a 5 or 6. The Gemara will mention 2 ages because, and it'll say, had the bari, had the kochish, depends on the nature of the child. The weaker child, you'll start at the later time, and the stronger, the healthier child, you'll start at the earlier time. So it may be a similar type of idea here that, depending on the constitution of the child, then we will determine when we should start, at the age of 6, or you should start or postpone it to a later date. So another takana from Usha. Amar Rabbi Yossi bar Chanina, Bu'usha itkinu, Aisha shemachra b'nichsei melog, B'chayei bala, a woman who sells her nifsei melog in the time of the lifetime of her husband, umeita, she predeceases her husband, a bal motzi mi'ad al-kuchot, the husband can go now and take that property back. So let's remember, with regards to the nifsei melog that a woman brings into the marriage, nifsei melog work this way, that she brings them in, their value is not assessed in the ketubah, and therefore the husband does not have to return the exact value, but rather the property itself to the woman. So if he passes away before his wife, then her ketubah will guarantee her the return of those nichsei melog. In the interim, the husband is entitled to the peirot, the output, the production of those fields. On the other hand, if the woman predeceases the husband, then he is yoresh ketubata. He inherits her ketubah, as we saw earlier, that ketubata neged kfurata. He ensures that she is buried and takes care of the burial expenses. In exchange for that, he inherits her ketubah. So over here, the nichsei melog, if she predeceases him, will fall to him. They'll be his property. If he passes away first, then the nichsei melog belong to the woman. So if a woman goes ahead and does a sale of the nichsei melog, in terms of currently, she's unable to sell the nichsei melog because the husband has a lien on the output, on the leasehold of the property. So she can sell them, but in terms of transference of ownership, nothing's going to happen because the husband will still collect the leasehold from the property or he'll get the production of the property. On the other hand, it's a forward sale that has 2 possible outcomes. One possible outcome is that the husband dies, and therefore the nichsei melog will go to the woman. In that case, the sale is a good sale, because in the end, she owned the property fully, and she made a forward sale of that property, and it'll work, and that's fine. On the other hand, if she predeceases the husband, then the property does not revert to her, but rather reverts to the husband. And the husband's lien on the property seemingly precedes the sale of the property. If you say that kinyan peirot is kinyan karka, then you don't need this at all. If you say that the kinyan peirot is not like kinyan karka, this is the takana of Usha, which says that the husband's lien precedes the lien of any of the purchasers. And therefore, since he's entitled to inherit the land in the end, the full principal of the property, then he is allowed to take that property back from the lekuchot. Whether he has to actually reimburse the kuchot or not is subject to machloket rishonim, as well as whether the woman has to make restitution to the individual if she has other property, if she sold it with achrayut, all of these are machlokes rishonim, exactly what the nature of the takana is. But the basic idea is that if the woman makes a forward sale, the person who's buying it is buying it at risk. Because there is a possibility that they will lose this property and take it back, and they will take that into consideration in paying the price. They're basically buying an option on the property, or they're buying the actuarial probabilities of the wife or the husband dying first, which is that basically they're going to price it based on that. The likelihood that the woman passes away first, then they'll lose the property. The likelihood that the husband predeceases the woman, then they're going to get the property. So they're going to price, or they're going to buy the property based on knowing that risk, that there's an actuarial risk to the death or the lifespan of each of these individuals. And they'll pay in accordance with that. So maybe in that case, they won't get their money back because they assumed that risk in buying it. Whereas if you say that they paid full price for it, then they might be entitled to the money back because they thought they were purchasing from the woman who actually owned the rights to sell it to them. Meantime, the Takana Nusha says that the husband has precedence over that, and they really don't. So question of how you view this Takana and how we actually exercise the Takana. But the basic idea is that the husband has a first lien on the property when it comes to his wife predeceasing him. Ashkei Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef to Rav Yibo. Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef found Rav Yibo, the Abakai Boklusa de Usha. He was standing amongst the common folk in Usha, amongst a lot of people in Usha. Amalei Man Mora de Shmata de Usha. Who is the author of this statement about the Takana of Usha? It's Amalei Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina. It's Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina. If you remember when we started out the Sugya of Usha, the first time it was quoted was Amar Rabbi Yila, Amar Reish Lakish, Mishom, Rabbi Yehuda Bar Chanina. Over here, it says it's Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina. So, Tani Minei Arba In Zimnin. He reviewed it with him 40 times. V'damilei Kaman Demanchalei Bekiste. And then it was like he had it in his pocket, meaning that he really got a hold of it. Rashi claims over here that he reviewed it 40 times in order to remember the attribution. Who was the Bala Memra? Seemingly that original, or the version that he had seen originally was Rabbi Yehuda Bar Chanina. And then when he found out it was Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, then he wanted to change it in his mind and make sure that he had it clear that it was Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina and not Rabbi Yehuda Bar Chanina. The other way you could learn it, obviously, is that he reviewed the actual Memra 40 times. Not just the attribution, but the whole Memra. Once he knew it was Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, who was a great Rav, then he said, okay, then this is worth going over. This is a serious Takana. And therefore he reviewed not only the attribution, but also the Takana itself. Ashrei Shomrei Mishpat. Lucky is the one, praise be the one who maintains equality or proper behavior. He does tzedaka, he is generous in giving at all times. Is it really possible to give tzedaka at all times? I mean that it's a discreet mitzvah. Since it's a discreet mitzvah, how could it be that a person is permanently giving tzedaka? Darshu Rabbeinu should be avne. So the Rabbanan and Yavna were Doresh, V'amila Rabbi Eliezer, and some say this was Rabbi Eliezer, Ze'azan Banav Ubnotav Sheng Tanim. This is someone who supports his children while they are youngsters. This goes back to the Takana of Usha, that Usha Itkinu She'adam Zanet Banav Ubnotav Sheng Tanim, which indicates or implies that he is not obligated to take care of them. And therefore the only reason he takes care of them is Michinat Staka. And so, basically, a person can be giving tzedakah at all times because he is raising his children. By raising, maintaining, and sustaining one's children, then you are giving tzedakah at all times. Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachmani Amar, Zeh Megadel Yatom V'Yatoma B'Toch Beito U'Masiyan. This is when it brings up an orphan, male or female orphans in their house, and marries them off. So that's, again, another continuous form of tzedakah. It's more interesting because it's a form of gemilat chesed that involves monetary expenditure, and therefore it's deemed to be tzedakah, not just gemilat chesed, but that again is a continuous process because you're raising them, you're bringing them up. Just like when one raises a child, there's continuous expenditures in providing shelter and taking care of them, sending them to school. So too with the yatom, the yatoma, this is a type of tzedakah b'cholet. Hon va'usher bebeito, v'tzidkato medelat. He has wealth and plenty in his house. Bitzidkato, and his righteousness, Omed Elad, stands forever. Ravuna, Rav Chista. We have a machloket between Ravuna and Rav Chista. Chadamar, Zelomei Torah, Umlamda. This is someone who learns Torah and teaches it. Chadamar, Zekotev, Torah, Nevi'im, Ktuvim. This is someone who writes Tanakh, meaning that they This is in a time when we're talking about writing with a sofer and writing on a scroll. Umashilan acherim, and then lends them out to others. So what you basically have here is you have keren and peirot, which is the person who learns, has the zchut, and the Torah stays with them forever. So they have hon va'osher bebeito, they have wealth, and they have an accumulation of their own. But sitka do amir lad is because this person has taught Torah to others, and that Torah will then go out and be permanently with the other people. And so therefore what he teaches does not diminish from the hon or the osher beito, but it creates its tzedaka la'ad. So that's the idea. You have talmidim, and those talmidim have talmidim, so on and so forth. And the same is true with writing these sfarim. The sfarim will be permanently there for you. The hon v'osher, they remain intact for you. But in granting them to others to learn, then you're tzedakato meredad, that you also get the benefit of them being utilized by others without the loss of the underlying sefer that's there. Urei vanim livanecha, shalom al Yisrael. When you see children to your children, then there is peace amongst Klal Yisrael. I'm Rabbi Shulman Levi. Kevin shabanim levanecha, shalom al Yisrael. Once you have grandchildren, then there's shalom al Yisrael. Delo ati lidei chalitza v'yubum. Because then your children will not have issues of chalitza and yibum because they now have children. So the children's children either protect the children from having to do chalitza yibum, or they might even protect the grandparent from having to do chalitza and yibum, because we've learned before in Masechet Yevamot that you have to be bodek, and even a grandchild, any offspring is sufficient to prevent the individual from having to undergo yibum or chalitza. So as soon as you have another generation, the assumption is that that gives a person sufficient number of offspring that there's no longer a risk that you will have yibum or chalitza. Or, again, it's Shalom al Yisrael is that next generation. Once they have children, then you know that your children are protected from chalitza and yibum. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani amar, kemin shbanim levanecha. Once you have grandchildren, shalom al dayanei Yisrael. Then there's peace for the judges of Israel, delo atili intuye. Because then there's no longer arguments about who's going to inherit over here. Once you have a male child, it's very clear where the inheritance is going to go. Even actually if it's a bat, even if there's a daughter there, it's very clear that the inheritance goes to the child. They're the first in line in terms of inheritance, and there's no question that they are the first in line. If, for whatever reason, they don't have children, then you start having to figure out who's the closest relative to this individual and to inherit, and then the family starts to fight over who are the entitled parties to the inheritance over here. Once there's a child, there's a clear definition of where the inheritance is going, and therefore we save ourselves a lot of court time, even though, unfortunately, we find many times that even amongst children, there's a tremendous amount of fighting in terms of Yerusha from parents, and so that the court systems are full of families fighting over those Yerushot. All right, Zeh Midrash Darash, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah lefnei Chachamim. This was the Midrash that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah had before the Chachamim, where he compared the Ketubah with regards to the children inheriting, the sons inheriting, to the daughters being Nizon, being fed out of the estate. Yatev Yav Yosef Kameid Rav Hamnuna. Rav Yosef was sitting before Rav Hamnuna. Tosfot already raises the issue that Rav Yosef seemingly here is a Talmid of Rav Hamnuna. Yet we find in other places that Rav Hamnuna was a Talmid of Rav Chista, and Rav Yosef and Rav Chista were peers. So Tosfot says it here, he says in many other places that there were two Rav Hamnunas. So there's one Rav Hamnuna who is the Rebbe, or seemingly older than Rav Yosef, and there's another Rav Hamnuna who would be younger than Rav Yosef, who would be a Talmud of Rav Chista, who is a peer of Rav Yosef. So here, Rav Yosef is sitting in front of Rav Hamnuna, v'yotiv Rav Hamnuna v'kamar. Rav Hamnuna is sitting and saying, k'shem she'en abanim yoshim ela min hakarka. Just like the boys only inherit from the land, kach en abanot nizonot ela min hakarka. So too, the daughters only get sustained out of the land, the real property of the estate. Ava shalei kulei alma. Everybody started to scream. There was an uproar in the Beit Midrash after Rav Hamnuna said this. The Shavik Ara Hu Diartile Bnei. So what is it the case here? Only people who leave real property, only people who leave land, have children who inherit. The Lo Shavik Ara Lo Yartile Bnei. And if they don't leave real property, they only leave Mitautlin, the children don't inherit. Inheritance is only independent on real property. Inheritance doesn't apply to Mitautlin. So I'm Rav Yosef. So Rav Yosef speaks up now and says, "V'dilmak tubat benin dechin kamar." Maybe Rav Hamnuna was talking about what we discussed again yesterday, the day before, the tubat benin dechin. the ketubah that guarantees the male children of this woman to be the inheritors of her ketubah. Maybe that's what we're speaking about. Samarlei, Rav Amnuna says to Rav Yosef, Mar de Gavar Ravo, you who is a great individual, Yoda Mai Kamino, you understood what I meant. I mean that Rav Yosef quickly understood what Rav Nuna's intent was, whereas the rest of the Beit Midrash is in an uproar because they think he's saying there's only inheritance with regards to real property, not about Mitaltlin. On the other hand, what Rav Amnuna is saying is similar to what Rav Elazar ben Azariah says in the Mishnah, which is that there is a hekesh between Ketubat bin Din Dichrin and the Mizonot of the daughters. Ketubat bin Din Dichrin only applies to real property. Rashi over here, there's a very large Rashi over here, spends time showing that the necessity or the ability to give Ketubat bin Din Dichrin is only if we have residual property they'll write to divide up, and it's residual real property in the estate to divide up beyond the value of the ketubah of all the wives of this individual, and that's when we have a division. But we see that ketubah benin dichrin is subject to karka, is only about land. Now, why Rav Amnuna knows that ketubah benin dichrin is about karka versus metalklin more than he knows that about the banot and izonot mi karka and not metalklin is not clear. The Gemara never makes that statement. But that might be why Rashi is spending a lot of time showing you that the Mishnayot later on seem to imply that when it comes to Ketubat bin Din Dichrin, it's only about real property, not about Metaltalin. And therefore, we're going to extrapolate that based on the Hekesh to the Mizonot of the Banot, which means that Ketubat bin Din Dichrin will only apply to real property. And so too, the Banot that get Mizonot out of the estate will only apply to real property. Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Yosef, Rav Zan Michite Dalia. Rav Chiya bar Yosef says Rav actually sustained the Yitomot out of Chitim that were in the Aliyah, that were in the attic. So over here, the statement is that Rav used Metaltalin for Mizonot of the Yitomim in an instance where, after the death of their father, they came and the estate included these Metaltalin, which is against what we just said now, that Mizonot only get taken out of the real property. See, Bailu, Parnasa havyo? Some say, wait, this wasn't real mizonot, this was parnasa. Umay aliyah, and then what is aliyah? Aliyah doesn't mean an attic. Ela miluya da'av. From the assessment of the generosity of the father. Ukudishmuel, and similar to the member of Shmuel, Dama Shmuel, the parnasa shamin ba'av. When it comes to parnasa, we assess it based on the father. Now over here, parnasa is what we call nidunya, which is the dowry of the girls. Here we have these young girls who are living in the estate, their father has passed away, and then they want to get married. How do we know what type of dowry to provide for these young girls? So Shmuel tells us, the parnasa shamin ba'av. We assess based on the father what type of dowry to give. So for instance, if he already married off a daughter, then we know the kind of dowry that he intends to give to his daughters. And therefore, we'll look at that, extrapolate that, and say that the parnasa, the dowry that we give to the yitomim that are left, the yitomot that are left in the estate, will be based on what he gave to the ones before he passed away. Others say they look at the generosity of the individual. What type of individual? Is it a person that spent a lot, a person that was more miserly? We look at the individual, try to determine what parnasa. And that's what it means here. Aliyah doesn't mean literally an addict, but iluyah. It has to do with the generosity or the nature of the father. And that's what it means, Rav Zan Mechitei D'Aliyah. He used these Metaltalin to pay out the Parnasa, to pay out the Nidunya for these young Yitomot. That's one way to read it. That's one possibility. Tosafot over here says that there is a limit or a cap on this dowry, that it can't be more than Isur Nechasim. It can't be more than 1/10 of the estate, the dowry. So Tosafot here debates as to whether the subjectivity of the father can override that or is limited by that. And Tosafot really comes to the conclusion that the only thing the father can do is take it down. He can't take it up. Meaning that if the father was generous and he gave more than 1/10 of his possessions to the dowry of his daughter while he was still alive, then the subsequent daughters will not get more than 1/10 of the estate because that is the limit. That's the cap. Even though he was more generous than that. But if he was less generous than that, then we reduce it. So it is the lower of what the father would have given or 10% of the estate. One of those two, and that's the way Tosafot reads it in the end, that this idea that the father's generosity determines is only in terms of reducing it below the 10% of the estate, but not raising it above the level of 10% of the estate. Oh, Dilma, Mizone Mamash Avo. Or maybe literally it means Mizonot, that he was talking about here. Umaliyah. And then what is the Aliyah? Midvarim Tovim Shenem Rub Aliyah. Based on these good things that were said in the Aliyah, Damar Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef, Baliyah Yitzkinu, She'ed Benot, Nizonot, Minem Metaltalin. Because in the Aliyah they are Mitakein. Now the Aliyah here is a reference generally to meetings of the Chachamim. See that throughout Shas, why they're meeting in the Aliyah, whether that was for privacy, or whether that was to escape the persecutions of the Romans. So they were meeting in the Aliyah. So this is one of these takanot that was established over there, that the benot are mizonot mina mitaltalim, that benot are given that right to take mizonot out of the mitaltalim. Now, interesting enough, the Gemara is unwilling to say that Rab meant something literally. Aliyah was the attic, and he literally took the chitim out of the Aliyah. The Gemara gives one of two interpretations, both of which don't take the Aliyah literally here in terms of the storage of the chitim in the Aliyah. So I saw one piece of speculation that in Bavel it was not common to have aliyot. It wasn't common to have an upper level or an upper floor. And so because of that, the Gemara assumes that when Rav says it was an Aliyah, it was unlikely to literally mean the Aliyah. And therefore it meant it represented either a euphemism for Iluya, for the generosity of the father, or Aliyah was based on the Rav Yitzchak Bar Yosef, which was the Aliyah, which was the place where they went to meet in terms of the Chachamim, but not literally the Aliyah where they stored things. It was more common in Eretz Yisrael than in Bavel, and therefore they see the Aliyah referencing this idea of an Aliyah being a place of learning in Eretz Yisrael rather than in Bavel. Alright, that's a possibility as to why the Gemara is unwilling to take Rav literally. The other possibility is because the Gemara doesn't really want Rav to argue on Shmuel, or not to agree with the position of Shmuel, and in that way, here we can reconcile that difference by saying that Rav actually agrees to what Shmuel said. Alright, Tashma, Bidei de Rabbi Banai, Achua de Rabbi Chir Ba'abo. So there was this instance or case by Rabbi Banai, the brother of Rabbi Chir Ba'abo. Havu Metaltalim Diatme. He was the executor of an estate for Yitomim. Atu de Kamei de Shmuel, they came before Shmuel Amalei, Zil Zon. Go ahead and provide them Mizonot. My love, le mizone, ukud Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Yosef severely. What does that mean literally? Give them mizonot, like Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Yosef says. Lo, hotom le pana sahabai. No, he didn't mean to give them mizonot literally, sustain them, but rather their dowries. Ushmol le tamei. And this is shmol le shitato, the mar shmol le parnasa, shemim ba'av. That by the parnasa, we assess the generosity of the father. And in assessing the generosity of the father, then the nedunya is taken out of even the metaltalei, because we look at all that's there, everything that's in the estate, in order to help out the daughters. There was an incident in Narda, but don't dine the Narda. And the judges in Narda adjudicated the case, and they gave the yitomot out of the metaltalei mizonot. Pumpadita. There was a case in Pumpadita, Bagbe Rav Chana Bar Bizna. And Rav Chana Bar Bizna also, again, executed in that way and gave mizonot out of mitaltalin. Amar lehu Rav Nachman, zilu ahaju. You better reverse your psak, you better reverse your positions. Vilo, if you don't reverse it, I'm going to sell your houses from under you to repay these individuals who you took wrongly from. The Tosafot says over here that Rav Nachman clearly believes that this was a ta b'dvar mishnah. It's a mistake of a Dvar Mishnah where the case is reversible. It was not just Shikul Adat. It was a Talab Dvar Mishnah. Matar Dvar Mishnah, we reversed the case. And we have to assume here it was a case where we reversed the case. And the judges, even though they might have smicha, are held accountable for the reversal of the case. And they have to personally pay out. Probably according to Rabbi Meir, who says, we're don dina de garmi. And since this is a case of garmi, that they caused the loss, then they're going to be held accountable for causing this loss. Or the possibility is that Rav Nachman, instead of reversing the case, went to them and said, you have to reverse the case, because he felt that the litigants would not listen to him, but they would listen to the judge on the case, and he's saying to them, you guys got to reverse the case. And that's why Rav Nachman didn't take it in his own hands and reverse it. But he does threaten them with the loss of their houses if they don't do it, whether that's simply to place pressure on them, and it was not Minadin that he placed pressure on them, or whether that was Minadin that he put pressure on them and said, listen, if you don't pay it back, then you're responsible to make sure that you pay restitution to the party that lost over here because you judged incorrectly in this case. Rabbi Yami and Rabbi Yassi suffer the mezan mimetaltele. They thought to give mizonot to yitomot out of the mitaltelin. Amaloi Rabbi Yaakov Ba'idi, milta Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish lo aldo ba uvda. Things that Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish were not willing to do. Atun abdin ba uvda. You are willing to do. Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish weren't willing to take out of mitaltelin to feed the yitomot, and all of a sudden you feel empowered to do that. Rabbi Lazar suffered the mezan mitaltelin. Rabbi Lazar also had a havamina to give out of the mitaltelin. Malafanav Rabbi Shimon ben Eliyakim. Rebbe, Yodeani Bechash, Emi Data Dina Tausta. I know that you're not doing this because that is the letter of the law. Elamidat Rachmanut. But because you feel bad, you feel a certain amount of compassion for these Yitomot. Elashemi Yerua Tamidim Vikavu Allachaludorod. It's a dangerous precedent that you're setting. And even though you're doing it because you're having compassion on the Yitomot and you're almost doing Mitzad Staka, nevertheless, if other people see you adjudicate the case in this way, they will see this as a precedent for feeding Yitomot out of the Mitaltelin, and from that will come out of Churvah. So you have to be careful here. Even though you might want to do it, you have to also be careful about the implications of doing it and what others are going to learn from you doing it. How the act of the commander of Yosef? Amalu havala mitamre da'abudja. Rav Yosef said you should give from those dates that are out on the mats. They used to put mats under the palm trees. So when they went to pick out the dates or pick the dates or shake the dates off the tree, they would fall on those mats. They would protect from becoming dirty or ruined. And then they would roll them up or pick them up afterwards with all the dates on them. So there were dates sitting on there. And Rav Yosef said, go ahead and you can give mizonot from those mitamri d'albuja. Amalei Abaye, Abaye who's the Talmud Rav Yosef says, ilu b'chov hava ki ay gavna mi'ava goyov yulei mar. If this was a regular creditor over here, would you grant him the right to collect from these dates that are on the mats? These are metaltalin. And the metaltalin of Yitomim are not subject to liens of creditors. It's only real property that's subject to liens of creditors, mostly because of the fact that, as Rashi says here, creditors really only rely on property, because property doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't walk, doesn't leave, and therefore they're lien, or they're only somech dat on property that's going to be around, and they'll have a way to collect. On the other hand, metaltalin, which can be spent to get covered up and moved around, over there, people are not sumech on them. Therefore, property is seen as the lien or the recourse for these individuals to collect on, and not the metaltalin. The same is true here by the zonot of the banot, that their lien is really only the real property. It's not on the metaltalin. Why are you granting them the rights to metaltalin over here? So I'm like, techazia lebudaya kamina. I'm saying not that they were on the mats yet, but they're ready to go on the mats. They're still attached to the tree. And they're ready to be shaken off. They're ready to be picked at this point to go onto the mats. So, in the end, anyway, so even though you're right, so now it's still mechuber the karka, so it should have a din of karka. Nevertheless, we have a principle that anything that is ready to be picked is as if picked. Now, really, this is all according to the shita of Rabbi Shimon. It's actually a machoket chachamim and Rabbi Shimon. But the truth is, we pass them like Rabbi Shimon, and therefore the Gemara brings it down as if, you know, that it is the sheet of Rabbi Shimon this way. So Gemara says, no, it's a case that tzricha ledikla kamina. That even though, yes, they're ready to be picked, they still require sustenance from the tree. If they were to be severed from the tree at this point, then that might ruin the dates, or they might actually not make it to their final picking stage. And therefore, since they are still dependent on the palm tree, therefore, they are considered to be mechuber the karka. The mechuber the karka, they have a din like real property. And since they have a din like real property, that's why Rav Yosef is willing to give the banot, mizonot, out of these dates over here. So Tosfot mentions in many places, he mentioned it about a daf ago also, on Memtet and with Bet, towards the bottom of Divrei HaMatko, Huvi Ishto Nizonimim, he brings down, Lefima Shetiknu HaGeonim. That the Geonim instituted that there was a change in the dynamic of recourse, which was that the Gemara clearly says that real property is the only thing that people have liens on. But the Geonim saw that the nature of transacting was changing, and the nature of accumulation of wealth was changing, and there were people in Bavel in the time of the Geonim who were extremely wealthy, but yet owned no land. They were merchants. And therefore, what are you going to say? That these people, all their creditors and their tubot and all these things have no liens on their property, on their wealth, because they don't own any property. And they said, so the nature has changed, where now people's accumulation of wealth is not just in real property, but it's also in metaltalin. And therefore, people are somecha metaltalin on the wealth of individuals. And therefore, the gonim extend to the fact that the ketubah does have a lien not only on the real property of the individual, but be collected out of the metaltalin of the individual. And the question always is, how far does that extend? If we're going to say that metaltalin is like real property, do we say that not only for the ketubah, but do we also say that for regards to ketubah b'nein dichrin? Do we say that also here for the banot nizonot? Does the metaltalin really change into real property in the sense that for everything now it's going to be considered real property? Or was the Geonim's takana much more limited just to the ketubat isha and maybe to Balei Chov that they have the right to collect that of metaltalin, but not that that was a more general statement that real property and metaltalin now are completely equal? Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Nun Aleph, Amud Aleph.